A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about apartment sizing. What square meterage actually works for different living situations? Singles, couples, families with kids, people working from home. And he wants real numbers, not just, it depends. Which I appreciate, because it depends is what you say when you don't actually want to help someone.
It's also what you say when the question genuinely depends on about 12 variables. But I take your point. There are actual benchmarks here, and most people shopping for apartments have no idea what they are. They walk into a place, it feels big or it feels small, and they make a decision based on vibes.
Vibes, and whether the kitchen gets good light. Which, by the way, I stand by that being underrated.
You've mentioned, but square meterage, or square footage, depending where you are, is one of those things where people don't know the numbers until they've already made an expensive mistake. And by the way, before we dive in, today's script is being written by DeepSeek Vi4 Pro.
Welcome aboard, DeepSeek. Hope you've got strong opinions on floor plans.
Let's start with the baseline. The Wirecutter did a pretty comprehensive piece on this, and they landed on some numbers that I think are actually reasonable. For a single person, they say around 55 to 65 square meters. That's roughly 600 to 700 square feet is the sweet spot. Below that, you start making real trade-offs.
Below that? And your bed is also your couch and your dining table.
And there's a difference between, I can technically live in this space, and this space doesn't actively make me miserable. Those are not the same bar. The Bankrate analysis pointed out that the average new apartment in the U.S. has been shrinking, down about 5% over the last decade, while the number of people working from home has obviously shot up.
Which is a terrible combination. Because working from home doesn't just mean you need a desk. It means you need psychological separation between work and not work. And in a studio that's 40 square meters, you're eating dinner 3 feet from where you just had a tense call with your boss.
That's the thing most square footage guides miss. They're counting functional space. Can you fit a bed? Can you fit a desk? But they're not accounting for what I'd call the sanity margin. The Redfin piece touched on this indirectly when they talked about layout mattering as much as raw numbers. A well-designed 55-square-meter apartment can feel more livable than a poorly designed 70.
Okay, so let's give people actual numbers. Break it down by scenario. Start with a single person.
For a single adult, no kids, no roommate, the real floor where you're not making yourself crazy is about 40 square meters. That's around 430 square feet. At that size, you're in a studio. Everything is one room except the bathroom. You've got a kitchenette, a bed that's probably a Murphy bed or a day bed if you're smart about it, and you're making peace with the fact that your living space is compact.
40 square meters is also where you start having to make choices that sound small but add up. Like, do you own a vacuum cleaner or do you sweep? Because storing a vacuum is a real commitment at that size.
And that's something nobody tells you. The storage overhead of basic household items starts competing with living space. But if you can push to 50 or 55 square meters, you start getting a one-bedroom situation. Actual separation between sleeping and living areas. That's the threshold where you can have someone over without them sitting on your bed.
Which, for dating, is not nothing.
For a couple, two adults sharing, the Wirecutter recommendation is around 70 to 80 square meters. About 750 to 860 square feet. That gets you a one bedroom with a living room that's actually a living room, not a hallway with a sofa in it.
That's two people who like each other. If we're talking roommates who don't share a bed, the math changes completely.
Roommates need private space in a way couples don't. A couple can share a bedroom happily at 70 square meters. Two roommates probably need 85 to 90 square meters minimum to not want to murder each other, because you need two real bedrooms and common space big enough for two separate lives to coexist.
The common space thing is interesting, because that's where a lot of floor plans fail. They'll give you two decent bedrooms and then a living room that's 12 square meters, and you end up with two people who never leave their rooms.
which defeats the purpose of having a living room. The Redfin analysis found that common areas under about 18 square meters tend to be dead zones. People don't use them. They become expensive storage.
For roommates, 90 square meters, and you want at least 20 of that in common space.
Now let's get to families. This is where I see people make the most expensive mistakes, because they underestimate what a child does to space requirements.
Daniel and Hannah have Ezra, so I assume this is at least partly personal for him.
A couple with one young child, under 5, can manage in about 80 to 90 square meters if they're smart about it. 2 bedrooms, 1 bathroom, living area, kitchen. The child's bedroom doesn't need to be huge at that age, but the key word there is manage.
Manage is doing a lot of work in that sentence.
Because small children don't stay small, and their stuff expands to fill whatever container you give it. When the kid is a baby, you want the nursery close to your bedroom. When the kid is 3, you want a door you can close so you don't have to look at the tornado of toys. When the kid is 7 or 8, they need space for friends, a desk eventually, and the ability to make noise without it being on top of you.
What's the number where a family with one kid is actually comfortable, not just managing?
I'd say 100 to 110 square meters. That's roughly 1,100 to 1,200 square feet. 3 bedrooms, master, kids' room, and either a guest room or a home office that doubles as one. 2 bathrooms, ideally, because the morning routine with 1 bathroom and 3 people gets ugly fast.
2 bathrooms is one of those things that sounds like a luxury until you've lived without it.
It's the difference between we need to coordinate shower schedules and we just live our lives. For 2 kids, you're looking at 120 to 140 square meters. 4 bedrooms, if you can swing it, master, 2 kids' rooms plus a flex space. 2 bathrooms minimum, preferably 2.5.
At that point, you're also thinking about things like, can the kids play outside? Is there a balcony or a courtyard? Because square meterage inside is only half the equation when you've got multiple children.
And it gets overlooked in a lot of these guides because they're focused on interior square footage. But outdoor space, even a small balcony, changes the psychological footprint of an apartment dramatically.
I want to dig into the home office thing specifically, because that's changed the math for a lot of people in the last few years.
Pre-2020, a home office was a nice-to-have. Now, for a huge chunk of the workforce, it's non-negotiable. And a real home office is not a desk in the corner of the living room. A real home office is a door you can close.
Or, at minimum, a space that's visually and acoustically separate. I've seen people try to work from their kitchen table for years, and it wears on you in ways you don't notice until you stop.
The bank rate analysis flagged this. Buyers and renters now consistently rank a dedicated workspace as a top 3 priority, alongside kitchen size and storage. So if you're working from home full-time, you need to add about 8 to 12 square meters, roughly 100 to 130 square feet, to whatever baseline you'd otherwise target. That's a real room, not a nook.
If both partners work from home,
then you need either 2 separate offices, which is a big ask, or 1 office large enough for 2 workstations with some separation, plus the understanding that someone's going to need headphones. I'd say add 15 to 20 square meters to the couple's baseline. So instead of 70 to 80, you're looking at 90 to 100, just for 2 people, no kids, both working remotely.
That pushes a lot of couples into 3-bedroom territory, just to have 2 bedrooms and an office.
Which is exactly what's happening. 3-bedroom apartments are being snapped up by childless couples specifically for the office space. It's one reason rental prices for 3 bedrooms have outpaced 2 bedrooms in a lot of cities.
Let's talk about what's too small. Where's the line where you're actually harming your quality of life?
There's research on this, and it's not just about comfort. Studies on crowding have found that when adults have less than about 15 square meters of personal space, total apartment square footage divided by occupants, you start seeing increased stress markers, more conflict, poorer sleep quality. For children, the effects are even more pronounced. Kids in crowded housing show higher cortisol levels and lower academic performance.
For a family of 4, that's 60 square meters as the absolute floor before you're in documented negative outcomes territory.
And 60 square meters for 4 people is tiny. That's a 2-bedroom where the kids share a room and there's basically no common space. People do it. People have to do it, especially in expensive cities, but it's not neutral. It has real costs.
Which brings up an uncomfortable point. A lot of these guidelines assume a certain budget. What do you tell someone who can't afford the 70 square meters for a couple or the 100 square meters for a family?
That's the real conversation. Because it's easy to say, here's the ideal, and much harder to say, here's what you do when the ideal isn't available. I think the honest answer has two parts. First, you prioritize ruthlessly. If you can only afford 50 square meters for two people, figure out what actually matters. Is it sleep quality? Then protect the bedroom. Make it a sanctuary, even if the rest of the apartment is tight. Is it cooking? Then invest in the kitchen and accept that your living room is going to be small.
That's zone-based thinking, which you've talked about before. Don't try to make every room good. Make the rooms you actually use good, and let the others be functional.
The second part is, you get creative about offloading functions. If your apartment is too small to have guests over comfortably, you become the person who hosts at the park or at a restaurant. If you don't have space for a home office, you find a co-working space or a library that works for you. You stop trying to make your apartment do everything.
There's also the question of how long you plan to stay. Because the square footage that works for a couple with a newborn is not what works for a couple with a 10-year-old.
The timeline question is huge, and it's where I see people make costly errors. They buy or sign a long lease based on their current situation without thinking about the next 5 years. If you're planning to have a kid in 2 years, don't rent the charming 55 square meter one bedroom just because it's a good deal right now. The cost and hassle of moving in 2 years will eat whatever you saved.
Unless you're in a market where moving is easy and cheap. But most people aren't.
Most people aren't. And moving with a baby or toddler is a special kind of nightmare. My rule of thumb is, if you're buying, buy for your life in 5 years, not your life today. If you're renting, you can be a little more present focused, but you should still have a realistic timeline for when you'll outgrow the space.
Let's get into some specifics that people might not think about. What about ceiling height? Does that change the equation?
A 40 square meter studio with 3 meter ceilings feels completely different from the same footprint with standard 2.4 meter ceilings. There's actually a psychological effect where higher ceilings promote more abstract creative thinking, while lower ceilings promote more focused, detail-oriented thinking. Joan Myers Levy at the University of Minnesota published a fascinating study on this.
If you're an artist, get high ceilings. If you're an accountant, low ceilings might actually help you focus.
I'm not saying choose your career based on ceiling height, but it's not nothing. More practically, high ceilings give you vertical storage options. In a small footprint, going up is one of the best ways to reclaim space. Floor-to-ceiling shelving, lofted beds, overhead storage, all of that becomes possible with an extra half meter of height.
Storage in general is something these square meterage guides tend to gloss over. They'll say 70 square meters is fine for a couple, but they don't mention whether that includes closet space or whether you need to buy external storage.
The Bankrate piece noted that newer apartments tend to have less built-in storage than older ones, even at the same square footage. Open floor plans look great in photos, but they often mean fewer walls, which means fewer closets. So a 70 square meter apartment built in 2020 might have significantly less usable storage than one built in 1980.
Which means you need to actually look at the floor plan and count the closets. Don't just look at the total number.
Count the closets, and also think about what doesn't fit in closets. Where do you put your vacuum? Your winter coats in summer? If the answer is, I guess in the corner of the bedroom, you're going to feel cramped no matter what the square meterage says.
What about kitchens? I feel like kitchen size is one of those things where people either care deeply or not at all.
The divide is real. There are people who cook every meal from scratch and need counter space, and there are people whose oven is basically a second closet. For the first group, kitchen square footage is non-negotiable. I'd say you want at least 8 to 10 square meters for a functional kitchen if you actually cook. Enough for a proper work triangle between sink, stove, and fridge, plus some counter space. Below that, you're in kitchenette territory, and you're going to be frustrated.
For the second group, you can get away with much less. But you should be honest with yourself about which group you're in before you sign a lease.
The number of people who think they're in the second group and then discover they're actually in the first group about 3 months into living somewhere is not zero.
Let's talk about bathrooms. You mentioned two bathrooms for families. What about for couples? Is one bathroom fine?
One bathroom for two people is totally fine for most couples. It becomes a friction point if both people have identical schedules and both need the bathroom at the same time every morning, but that's usually solvable with a slight stagger. Where one bathroom becomes a real problem is when you have guests staying over, or when one person has, let's say, digestive issues that require extended bathroom occupancy. I'm a retired pediatrician. I've lost all sense of delicacy about bodily functions. The point is, a second toilet, not even a full second bathroom, just a water closet, is one of the highest return investments in domestic harmony you can make. If you're looking at two otherwise similar apartments, and one has a half bath, take the one with the half bath.
A half bath adds what? 2 or 3 square meters?
About 2.5 to 3 square meters, yeah. And it's worth every centimeter. I'd trade 3 square meters of living room for a second toilet without hesitation.
No, that's a strong take.
It's a correct take. Ask anyone who's ever had food poisoning while their partner was in the shower.
What about outdoor space? You mentioned it earlier, but let's put some numbers on it.
For a balcony, even a small one, say 4 to 6 square meters, the value is disproportionate to the size. A balcony that can fit 2 chairs and a small table extends your living space in a way that's hard to quantify but easy to feel. For families with kids, a balcony or terrace is almost essential unless you live directly adjacent to a park.
Ground floor outdoor space versus upper floor balcony. Does that change the calculation?
Ground floor outdoor space is larger, typically, but comes with trade-offs. Less privacy, more street noise, potentially more pests. Upper floor balconies are smaller but feel more like an extension of the apartment rather than a compromise with the street. A ground floor patio is great if you have kids who need to run around. A balcony is better for adults who want to drink coffee and read.
Let's get into some market-specific numbers, because square meterage means very different things in different cities.
This is where it gets bracing. In Hong Kong, the average apartment is about 45 square meters. In Tokyo, about 65. In New York, around 80. In Sydney, new apartments average about 130 square meters, though that's been trending down. In much of suburban America, you're looking at 200 plus for a single-family home, but that's not really the apartment market we're talking about. The UK has some of the smallest new-built homes in Europe. The average new apartment is about 76 square meters, down from around 85 in the 1970s. Germany averages higher, around 90 to 100. Scandinavia tends to be in the 70 to 80 range, but with extremely efficient layouts.
When Daniel's asking for guidelines, the answer partly depends on where he's looking. Jerusalem's market is going to be different from Dublin's.
Jerusalem tends toward larger apartments by Israeli standards. You're often looking at 100 to 120 square meters for a 3-bedroom family apartment, sometimes more in older buildings. But the layout conventions are different. Israeli apartments often have a merpuset, a balcony that functions as an extra room for much of the year. That changes the interior square footage calculation.
The climate piece is under-discussed in these guides. In a place where you can eat outside 8 months of the year, your interior space requirements shrink.
It's a real factor. In a cold climate where you're trapped inside for 5 months, you need more interior space just to not go stir-crazy. In a Mediterranean climate, you can get away with less because the outdoors is functionally part of your living space. The same 60-square-meter apartment that feels oppressive in Stockholm feels totally fine in Tel Aviv.
What about the trend toward micro-apartments? I've seen some that are 20, 25 square meters. Is that actually livable?
Micro-apartments are fascinating and also kind of concerning. At 20 to 25 square meters, you're talking about a space that's essentially a well-designed dorm room. You can do it, people do it, but it requires a level of minimalism and organization that most people don't naturally have. Every possession has to earn its place. You can't have a bookshelf full of books you might read someday. You can't have kitchen gadgets you use twice a year.
It's monastic almost.
And for some people, that's appealing. The freedom of not owning much, the lower costs, the environmental argument. But I think micro apartments get oversold as a lifestyle choice when for a lot of people they're a financial necessity dressed up in design language.
The "we're not poor, we're minimalists" thing.
I'm not against micro apartments as an option. They should exist, and they can be done well. But I'm skeptical of the narrative that they're the future of urban living for everyone. Most people, given the choice and the means, want more space than that.
Let's circle back to something you said earlier about layout mattering as much as raw numbers. What makes a layout good versus bad at a given square meterage?
A few principles. First, minimize hallway space. Hallways are necessary for privacy in larger apartments, but in anything under about 80 square meters, long hallways are just eating your square footage. Every meter of hallway is a meter that's not kitchen, not living room, not storage.
Look for apartments where rooms open directly onto each other or onto a central living area.
Second, natural light distribution. A well-laid-out 60-square-meter apartment with windows on two exposures will feel larger than a poorly laid-out 75-square-meter apartment with windows on only one wall. Light makes space feel usable. Dark corners are dead space. Third is kitchen placement. In smaller apartments, an open kitchen that flows into the living area is almost always better than a closed-off galley kitchen because it lets the cook be part of the social space. In larger apartments, a semi-open kitchen, maybe with a pass-through or a peninsula, gives you the best of both worlds. A fully closed kitchen only really makes sense above about 120 square meters, where you've got enough space that separation doesn't feel isolating.
What about the bedroom-to-bathroom ratio in terms of layout? I've seen apartments where you have to walk through the kitchen to get from the bedroom to the bathroom, and that seems like a design crime.
It is a design crime. The bedroom-to-bathroom path should be as short and private as possible. Walking through public spaces in your pajamas to get to the shower is terrible for everyone involved, especially if you have guests. Ideally, the bathroom is accessible from a hallway that also serves the bedrooms, not from the living room or kitchen.
If you're walking through the living room to get to the bathroom, that's a red flag.
That's a red flag, unless it's a powder room, a half bath for guests, which should be near the living area. But the main bathroom needs to be in the private zone of the apartment.
Let's talk about something that I think gets overlooked. The psychology of ceiling height in different rooms. You mentioned the creativity versus focus study, but does that apply differently to bedrooms versus living rooms?
Higher ceilings in living areas and kitchens tend to be universally positive. They make the space feel more open. But in bedrooms, it's more complicated. Some people find high bedroom ceilings unsettling. There's a primal thing about wanting a cozy, enclosed sleeping space. Other people love a dramatic bedroom with tall windows. There's no universal right answer, but it's worth paying attention to how you feel in high-ceilinged bedrooms before you commit.
That's the kind of thing you don't notice on a 10-minute apartment tour.
Which is why, whenever possible, you should spend real time in a place before signing. Not just a walkthrough, sit in the living room for 20 minutes. See how the light changes. Hear what the neighbors sound like. The square meterage tells you the quantity of space, but it doesn't tell you the quality.
For people buying rather than renting, I assume the tolerance for getting this wrong is a lot lower.
When you're buying, the transaction costs of getting out are enormous. I'd say if you're buying, you should know not just the square meterage, but the exact floor plan, the ceiling heights room by room, the storage dimensions, the window orientations. You should measure your existing furniture and tape out the floor plan in your current place to see how it fits. You should visit at different times of day. You should talk to neighbors about noise.
That sounds exhausting.
It is exhausting. It's also a lot less exhausting than buying the wrong apartment and trying to sell it 2 years later.
What about the financial side? How does square meterage translate to cost? And how do you know if you're overpaying for space?
Price per square meter is the standard metric, but it varies so much by location, condition, and building amenities. As a very rough benchmark, and this is going to vary wildly, in most mid-tier cities, you're looking at somewhere between $2,000 and $5,000 per square meter to buy, and proportionally less to rent. In premium cities, double or triple that.
For a 100 square meter apartment in a mid-tier city, you're looking at $200,000 to $500,000. In a premium city, six figures to well over a million.
What's more useful is comparing price per square meter across comparable apartments in the same neighborhood. If one apartment is 20% cheaper per square meter than everything else you're seeing, there's a reason, and you need to find out what it is before you get excited.
The reason is usually that it's above a bar, or next to a highway, or haunted.
Or the square meterage calculation is creative. I've seen listings where they count the balcony as interior space or include storage lockers in the total.
All right, let's try to synthesize this into something practical. If Daniel, or anyone, is apartment hunting right now, what's the checklist? What numbers should they have in their head walking into a viewing?
Here's my attempt at a framework. For a single adult, 40 square meters absolute minimum, 55 to 65 comfortable. For a couple, 65 minimum, 75 to 85 comfortable. Add 10 to 15 square meters per home office. For a family with one child, 85 minimum, 100 to 110 comfortable. Two children, 110 minimum, 130 to 140 comfortable. Add 5 to 10 square meters if you're in a cold climate where outdoor space isn't usable year-round.
Those are interior square meters, not including balconies or terraces.
Balconies and terraces are bonus space. Don't let a listing convince you that a 50 square meter apartment with a 10 square meter balcony is the same as a 60 square meter apartment. It's not.
What about the things that aren't captured in square meterage at all? What else should people be looking at?
You can have a perfectly sized apartment that's unlivable because you can hear your neighbor's conversations. Storage. We talked about closets, but also think about whether there's a storage locker in the basement, or bike storage, or a place for strollers if you have kids. Ventilation. Especially in kitchens and bathrooms, because mold is a square meterage independent problem. And ceiling height, which we covered.
The building itself matters too. An apartment that's the right size in a building with thin walls and no elevator is a different proposition than the same apartment in a well-built building.
The walk-up point is real, and I know you have feelings about this with strollers.
If you have a baby and a stroller, do not rent a walk-up. I don't care how charming the apartment is. You will be carrying that stroller up and down stairs multiple times a day, and it will break you.
It's one of those things where the inconvenience seems manageable in theory, and then becomes a grinding daily misery in practice.
There's no square meterage that fixes it. A perfectly sized apartment that's four flights up with no elevator is still a bad apartment for a family with a stroller.
So the final synthesis is, square meterage is a necessary metric but not a sufficient one. You need the right amount of space, but you also need that space to be well arranged, well lit, well insulated, and in a building that works for your life. The number alone won't save you from a bad floor plan, and a good floor plan can make a smaller number work.
Which is basically what Daniel was asking for. Guidelines, not gospel.
The numbers give you a starting point. They tell you what's reasonable to expect at your budget and your life stage. But the final decision always comes down to walking into a space and being honest about whether it feels like a place you can actually live, not just a place you can technically occupy.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Take it away, Hilbert.
In the 1920s, Soviet scientists drilling in Kamchatka reported a massive methane release from thawing permafrost so dramatic that locals claimed the ground breathed fire for 3 days. The incident was later found to be a misattribution. The fire was actually caused by a vodka still explosion at a nearby collective farm, and the methane readings were from the researchers' own faulty equipment.
Right. So the ground wasn't breathing fire. It was just bad science, and worse, vodka.
That's somehow both disappointing and deeply reassuring.
All right. So here's the forward-looking thought. As remote work keeps reshaping where people live, and as housing costs keep doing what they're doing, I think we're going to see more people making deliberate trade-offs between square meterage and location. Moving further out to get more space, or staying central and accepting less. The question is whether the guidelines we've talked about today still hold when the context shifts that much.
I suspect the core numbers will stay pretty stable. Humans don't change their spatial needs that quickly, but how people use the space will keep evolving, and the definition of enough will get more nuanced. It's worth revisiting in a few years.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to Daniel for the question, thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, and thanks to DeepSeek V4 Pro for writing today's script. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps.
Find us at myweirdprompts.com for past episodes and more. We'll be back soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. stay curious, keep weird in mind.